Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Our lead story today is out of Lemon Grove, where the City Council was considering censuring Councilmember Leanna LeBaron. We'll share highlights from the hearing, the outcome, and what Attorney Corey Briggs, representing Project Rope and Government, has to say on the matter. In Spring Valley, there's been another frightening incident of a man approaching a young girl near the Spring Valley Academy, this time actually grabbing her before fellow students shouted out and scared the suspect away. We'll have his description and details on our Crime Beat report. Plus, hear audio of a suspect who violently attacked an El Cajon police officer with a baseball bat and who now faces an attempted murder charge. And it turns out he has a long record of prior assaults on police officers. On our health report, hear about a rise in emergency room visits locally due to interactions between marijuana and prescription or over-the-counter drugs, and a new county program to educate consumers on this issue. Gas thefts are on the rise, and thieves are resorting to some surprising and expensive tactics in East County. We'll have details, plus some gas-saving tips for you on our show today. And we'll have a report on a bill in Sacramento that seeks to force oil and gas refiners in our state to disclose how much they're paying to determine whether price gouging is going on in California as prices at the pump continue to rise. A new safe gun storage law is now in effect in San Diego County. If you're a gun owner, find out what you need to know on today's show. Governor Gavin Newsom has appointed three new Superior Court judges to fill vacancies on San Diego's Superior Court. Learn who they are on our show today. And then on the second half of our show, we'll have some national news stories from Public News Service, including an address by Ukrainian President Zelensky to Congress and President Biden announcing new arms for Ukraine, or highlights of those. Biden also denounced Russian President Vladimir Putin as a war criminal for bombing civilian sites, including hospitals and a maternity ward. From California News Service, we'll have a report on Latino Advocacy Week and on Green Scene. Hear why some consumer health advocates are raising concerns about cell phone radiation impacts on fertility. Then on Destination East County, we'll have some top festivals and events coming up, from Daffodil Days in Julian to wine tasting events and more. And finally, we'll be re-airing our interview with Diana Lindsay, a classic. She's the author of Costa Cactus, a guide to hiking adventures across our region that we hope you can enjoy now that the weather is warming up this spring. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
It's a sad day in Lemon Grove that we've come to this. It's a sad day. I think that we are better than this. We're better than this. We are better than this. And I hope that this never happens again.
That was Lemon Grove Mayor Raquel Vasquez speaking at the special city council meeting last Tuesday night. It was held for one reason only: to debate a resolution that would formally condemn Councilmember Leanna LeBaron's behavior. The severity of the resolution was evident by its verbs, which included condemn, reject, admonish, refrain, and cease and desist. East County Magazine has previously covered the proposed censure resolution and the rising tensions in Lemon Grove. Yet no formal condemnation ever occurred. In the end, a motion to table the resolution was passed by 3-2. Mayor Raquel Vasquez and Mayor Pro Tem Jerry Jones voted no, while Councilmembers LeBaron, George Gastel, and Jennifer Mendoza voted in favor of tabling the action. This motion only narrowly carried after lengthy debate and an attempted substitute motion to approve the resolution made by Councilmember Jones, which only gained the support of Mayor Vasquez. The City Council may reconsider the resolution at any specified point going forward. While they will take no action for now, the night was not without consequence. The public and all council members each made their points clear, and a full room listened. The resolution calls out LeBaron for disrupting City Council meetings, overusing the City Hall conference room, and making claims of fraud against staffers without backing them up. It also reports that her hostilities toward city staff have allegedly been the cause of numerous complaints and vacant positions that have left the city legally vulnerable. Two public records requests to see any concrete written evidence were left unfulfilled in advance of the special meeting. One was submitted by attorney Corey Briggs on behalf of the Project for Open Government, the other by this media outlet. Both Briggs and this outlet asked to inspect records at City Hall, but were denied access, with the city claiming it needed 10 days to comply. A consistently cited point during the discussions was the city's potential liability due to LeBaron's actions at City Hall with staff. However, no evidence for such abuses were provided. City Clerk Audrey Malone explained to Mr. Briggs that the public records requests were received, but that the city attorney still needed to redact them to make them public records, if they did indeed exist. She also said the documents, as of Monday, were personnel records and had not been provided to council members, let alone the public. After his attempt to inspect the records, Briggs spoke with East County Magazine. You can watch videos of his visit to City Hall at eastcountymagazine.org. In them, he says,
Project for Open Government is concerned that voters are effectively disenfranchised because their representative is in effect being told that you can't do your job. If there are policy disagreements, that's what council members are supposed to do, debate the policy disagreements, and that's fine. But it would seem, given the lengthy accusations in a resolution that's backed up by nothing, that they simply don't like, they're trying to kill the messenger because they don't like the message. And that is unacceptable in a democracy. Right? If you disagree, you have a debate. And you show people to be wrong, but you don't silence them. So if there's no substance to this, if they go forward, Project for Open Government will sue.
Briggs also stressed the importance of backing up claims against the accused, especially when individuals happen to be critical of a government. Otherwise, the city comes off as stonewalling. For a moment during Tuesday's meeting, it seemed the resolution would face little trouble from the other four officials on the dais, as each council member acknowledged feeling the situation had reached a dire level, including Councilmember Jerry Jones. He said,
"We've tried to take steps incrementally in order to deal with the situation, the interruptions, the dysfunction, and so on. The first step we took was a manual that we created. And we put restrictions not just on Councilmember LeBaron, we put restrictions on all of us. All of us."
Yet the tide began to turn when Councilmember Gastel implored each council member to think about what they could do better to help resolve the matter, and proposed the idea of taking no action on the resolution to see if things improve. He said,
And I think that it'd be good if we all thought of how we could do better and how we could run the city better. And I'm looking for an alternative to passing the censure because I really do think we've all made our points, and I really do think the real question in front of us is how can we do better as a city.
For many members of the public in attendance, the successful motion to table the resolution was still a win. There was Penny Martinez.
To quote one of my favorite people, never ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble, necessary trouble. Thank you, Ms. LeBaron, for getting into necessary trouble to do what's right by us.
As well as Kathleen McLean.
I'm asking you to please support democracy tonight. Please do not put this resolution through. It would not be good for the city for the sake of transparency. I support integrity. And so I'm going to say it again for the people in the back. I support integrity.
However, not all in attendance felt the same, such as Helen Ofield.
Our city is home to largely middle class and very poor people who pay taxes to support the salary, health care, and perks for this appalling juvenile while receiving nothing in return. Ms. LeBaron's robbery of these residents and of the history of democracy in our city and state is beyond reprehensible. Pinch at her now, recall her now. Let us live to fight another day.
In total, 33 people gave public comment, the vast majority in support of LeBaron. Her community involvement and attentiveness were often cited, and many defended her behaviors. Clearly, the two sides are dug in deep. Is Councilmember LeBaron an appalling juvenile, or is she getting into necessary advocacy trouble? Is she opening the city up to liability, or is she the most dedicated public official currently elected in San Diego County? Bringing the resolution to condemn her before the public exposed these fault lines more than ever before. Perhaps it may also help close them. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Matthew Minosh with a Crime Beat report. The El Cajon Police Department has released body camera video showing an officer assaulted by a suspect with a baseball bat. The officer had responded to call on March 4th at Parkway Plaza Shopping Mall. The caller reported that the suspect had shoplifted and threatened citizens with the bat. On video, the officer can be heard calmly asking the suspect to drop the bat. Instead, the suspect said, "I want to kill you," and swung the bat at the officer's head.
261, cover now, 1 for 245 on a police officer with a bat.
I want to kill you, bro.
Fortunately, the officer was able to defend himself and restrain the suspect until backup arrived a few minutes later. The suspect, Julian Kirko, who was arrested and charged with attempted murder, he has a long history of criminal offenses, including convictions for 2 prior violent assaults on police officers, as well as making criminal threats and brandishing weapons. Even though he was convicted on 2 counts of violently assaulting police officers, Kirko was given credit for time served while awaiting trial and was released from custody in December 2021. Kirko had gone through drug rehab and mental health treatment programs while in jail. He was arrested twice for being under the influence of drugs in January and February of 2021. Kirko is now charged with attempted murder of a police officer and armed robbery. Fortunately, the officer has recovered and returned to duty. Lieutenant Randy Sollard sums up the difficulties that officers often face. He says, "Every day, police officers respond to calls for service in our communities, never knowing what they will encounter. Officers are often challenged with making split-second life and death decisions when threatened with unprovoked violent attacks as they perform their duties. While the news in recent years has focused attention on violence by police, this incident points out the problem of violence against police and raises questions over whether sentencing guidelines are adequate for repeat offenders with a history of violently assaulting the officers who protect and serve our communities." The suspect has pleaded not guilty.
This is Miriam Raftery with a warning for parents in the Spring Valley and Casa de Oro areas. A 13-year-old girl has reported that a man grabbed her from behind and inappropriately touched her on Friday, March 11th, around 4 o'clock at the intersection of Conrad Drive and Campo Road as she was walking home from Spring Valley Academy School. Other students yelled at the man, who walked away, and the student went home. Deputies searched the area after the incident but were unable to find the man. Deputies are conducting extra patrols and trying to identify the suspect, who matches the description of a man who reportedly approached another 13-year-old girl on February 28th near the same intersection and demanded that she get into his car, a black Toyota Prius. That girl ran across the street to campus and reported the incident to school staff. The suspect in both of these cases is described as a white man between age 29 and 30 with short, curly, red hair, freckles, and crooked teeth. He was wearing reading glasses and had a clean-shaven face. The Rancho San Diego Sheriff's Station wants the community to be aware of these incidents and caution children about safety precautions regarding strangers. It's always a good idea to avoid walking alone. If a stranger approaches or tries to have a conversation with you, tell your kids, "Do not respond. Walk or run away." They should not accept anything from a stranger or get in the vehicle of a stranger, no matter what they say. Report the incident to parents or school personnel, and most importantly, be sure to notify the sheriff's department as soon as possible. There was a delay of several days in reporting one of these cases. Anyone with information on these cases or the suspect is urged to contact the sheriff's department at the non-emergency line, which is 858-565-5200. You can also call Crime Stoppers to make an anonymous tip at 888-580-8477. Crime Stoppers is offering up to a $1,000 reward to anybody with information that leads to an arrest in these cases. You can visit sdcrimestoppers.org for information on how to send a web or mobile app tip as well.
This is Marie Johnson with a health report. Medical marijuana use has been legal in California since 1996, and recreational use for adults was legalized in 2016. But many users of cannabis or marijuana are not aware of potential negative impacts. Every day in San Diego County, an average of 37 people show up at hospital emergency rooms for reasons related to cannabis use. A common problem is drug interactions. For example, cannabis may increase the effects of pain medication, medications for anxiety or depression, and sleeping pills, causing over-sedation. Dr. Ronit Lev is an emergency and addiction physician and chief medical officer for the Center for Community Research in San Diego. "Every day I treat patients in the emergency department with marijuana poisoning," she says. "Lack of consumer protection and proper labeling have left consumers at risk for potential harmful consequences. That problem has become worse since recreational cannabis was legalized, since people can now access cannabis without talking to a doctor first." When medications are prescribed, doctors and pharmacists often don't warn patients about potential problems with using cannabis along with certain prescriptions, nor do patients receive any such warnings when buying over-the-counter medications. In what is believed to be the first of its kind in the U.S., the San Diego County Marijuana Prevention Initiative, or MPI, has established a program in partnership with pharmacies throughout our region aimed at raising awareness and providing consumers with information on how cannabis interacts with medication. Since the program was launched in September at the Sharp Reese Steely Pharmacy in Santee, over 10,000 information cards in English and 2,000 in Spanish have been distributed with prescription medications at 17 pharmacies countywide. The cards direct patients to an online resource, drugs.com, which lists common interactions between over-the-counter medications and the two active ingredients in cannabis, THC and CBD. Joe Eberstein, the program's manager, says it aims to reduce hospital emergency room visits. The project was developed by local pharmacists, doctors, and prevention providers. It also includes a survey to get consumer feedback, and so far, 90% of patients support the project. Dr. Seung Oh, pharmacy supervisor at Sharp Reese Steely and Santee, says before this project, there were very few pharmacies in San Diego County that provided drug interaction information with cannabis products. The project does not take a position for or against cannabis use. Dr. Oh explains, "We're simply here to increase awareness that just like drinking grapefruit juice could interact with important medication, cannabis could potentially do the same thing." Downtown San Diego has its own unique challenges. According to Dr. Aram Panaranda, pharmacy director at Allen Pharmacy, where many patients are vulnerable individuals with complex medical and mental health conditions. He says, "It is quite common to see on prescription labels, 'Do not take with alcohol or other drugs.' Unfortunately, marijuana use is often overlooked. If you use cannabis, medical experts say it's important to tell your doctor to ensure that any potential side effects from use with other medications are avoided."
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Gasoline prices are at an all-time high following a ban on importing gas from Russia as part of sanctions against Russia for invading Ukraine. As the price to fill up at the pump keeps going up, so are gas thefts. A locking gas cap available at auto parts stores can prevent siphoning. But now some thieves are resorting to using power tools to drill directly into gas tanks, causing major damage. It's happened locally in La Mesa, but is a trend across the nation. To reduce your odds of becoming a victim of gas theft, park your car in your garage if possible. Consider installing a security camera at your home or business, wherever vehicles are parked. When away from home, park in a well-lit area, preferably within view of a security camera. Park with the gas tank door facing the street, if possible, making any theft attempt visible to motorists passing by. Avoid parking in public places for long periods of time. For example, ask a friend or neighbor for a ride to the airport rather than leaving your car in the airport parking lot. Call 911 if you see suspicious behavior around parked cars. It may be difficult to tell if someone has siphoned your gas. The best way to find out is to keep track of your fuel level before you exit your car and make sure the level hasn't changed when you return. If you have a locking gas cap, check for scratches or damage where thieves may have attempted to steal your gas. Here are some tips to improve your vehicle's mileage to help you save on gas. Avoid high speeds, which reduce fuel efficiency. Maintaining a steady speed and avoiding excessive acceleration or deceleration can be fuel effective. Don't brake hard or make jackrabbit starts. Accelerating slowly and braking steadily can increase your fuel economy by up to 20%. Tire inflation should be checked regularly, as often as every 2 weeks, since improperly inflated tires reduce your vehicle's mileage. Open windows decrease a car's aerodynamic performance by up to 10%, so if the weather is mild, consider keeping windows closed. But air conditioning in your car puts extra load on the engine, causing more fuel consumption, especially in heavy traffic at low speeds. So on hot days, especially in traffic, opening the windows may be your best bet to ease the strain on your wallet. Keeping your car maintained can cut down on your fuel consumption costs. Regular checkups on fluid, engine, spark plugs, and other components can improve your car's performance. Lighten up your vehicle's weight by removing heavy items that you don't need. If you get rid of that box of books or weight set in your trunk, your vehicle will get better mileage. Consider carpooling, taking mass transit when possible, walking or bicycling for nearby errands. If your budget permits, consider buying a vehicle that is more fuel efficient, or better yet, a hybrid or fully electric vehicle to reduce or even eliminate your need to ever buy gasoline again. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report based on an article by J.W. August that first appeared in Times of San Diego and later in East County Magazine. Just how much do oil refiners make in California? That's a key question, with gasoline prices soaring, but only the owners of the 5 refineries in the state know the answer. They control 96% of gasoline made in California, according to the California Energy Commission. But soon, every driver in the state may be able to find out just how much refineries are making if Senate Bill 1322, the California Oil Refinery Cost Disclosure Act, gains traction in Sacramento. With California gas prices topping $5 to $7 a gallon in March, California State Senator Ben Allen joined with consumer advocates to announce his legislation that would make oil refiners disclose each month the price they pay for crude oil and the profit margins they make on the gas they refine and sell. It's time for transparency, according to Allen, because costs at the pump in California are inflated compared to neighboring states. But, he says, there's a big black hole when it comes to data with relation to the oil and gas industry, how they price gas at the pump, and the industry prefers that it stay that way. A state investigation by the California Energy Commission into gas pricing found in October 2019 that retailers in California were, way back then, charging more than other states for gasoline. California consumers have paid billions of dollars more than those in other states in recent years. As the report noted, in this state, the cost of gas is unregulated, so the price is whatever consumers are willing to pay. A request by Governor Gavin Newsom for the Attorney General's office to investigate the issue has resulted in no action so far by that office. Joining Senator Allen at a recent press conference was Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog. Court says California has been an ATM for oil refiners for too long. The pain at the pump is real. Now, according to court, the fossil fuel industry in California is not paying what they say they are paying for gas. It's time to pull the curtain back, he says. Kevin Slagle, spokesman for the Western States Petroleum Association, dismisses Consumer Watchdog's claims as theatrics. Slagle says the main reason for the cost of gas at the pump is the cost of crude. As to what the future holds, he says experts recognize that unforeseen events, as we are seeing in Ukraine and around the world today, can have significant impacts. But court says the reality of the California market is all smoke and mirrors. He notes, every time crude oil goes up, gas prices go up. But oil companies don't buy crude oil that day, or they don't buy it on the spot market. They buy crude oil on long-term contracts, and he says they are paying a lot less than what the world price really is right now. In other words, he's accusing them of price gouging. And his statement is backed up by commodities pricing for oil published in the Wall Street Journal. The watchdog organization claims the big oil refiners sell gasoline to their own branded outlets for 30 to 40 cents a gallon above the price they sell the same gas to Costco and United Oil. That extra profit tacked onto their own retailers is all profit, says court. Slagle, with the Petroleum Association, blames California regulations and taxes. Jen Engstrom, the director of CalPERG, a consumer advocacy group, says oil companies will blame increased costs on environmental protection laws. But that's only a small part of the costs that Californians are paying at the pump, according to Engstrom. She says, especially now when there is so much fluctuation with gas prices, it's important we have better transparency so we can all call out refineries if they needlessly raise prices. Senator Allen concluded the press conference with these words, "We ask the oil companies on behalf of California drivers, let's end the games of smoke and mirrors, open your books, and show the public your true costs of doing business." His bill moves next to the Senate Energy Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Communications, which is chaired by San Diego Senator Ben Hueso.
A safe gun storage ordinance took effect starting February 25th in San Diego County. It requires that all guns in homes or structures near a home be secured with a trigger lock or locked in a container. The only exception is if the firearm is within the immediate control of an authorized person. The ordinance applies to all unincorporated areas of San Diego County. Acting Sheriff Kelly Martinez says, "Gun locks are an important safety measure that can provide critical time between someone having an impulse and taking action." The San Diego Gun Owners Association has opposed safe gun storage measures, contending that they lengthen the time needed for a homeowner to defend themselves or family members in case of an intruder. The safe storage of guns was part of an ordinance passed in January that also regulates non-serialized firearms and non-serialized precursor firearm parts, commonly known as ghost guns. The measure takes aim at reducing the alarming number of deaths and injuries due to gun violence, including both violence by others and suicides. From 2015 to 2019, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, an average of 106 people were shot and killed every day in the United States. Another 210 people survived gunshot injuries each day. Out of more than 115,000 gun deaths every year in the United States, over 64,000 are suicides. More than 1,600 children and teens die of gunshots each year, on average. And 662 of those deaths of young people are suicides. The risk of suicide is double in homes where a firearm is kept loaded or unlocked, according to a Harvard University study. Nathan Fletcher, chairman of the County Board of Supervisors, says safe firearm storage saves lives and prevents gun violence. He calls the measure a common sense solution to keep families safe, especially children. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
Governor Gavin Newsom has appointed three judges to fill vacancies on the San Diego Superior Court. The judges include two prosecutors and a former public defender. Leonard Treen has been heading up the San Diego County District Attorney's hate crimes investigations, including prosecution at the shooter at the Chabad of Poway Synagogue. He has served as a deputy DA in San Diego since 2006 and fills a vacancy created by the retirement of Judge Timothy Casserly. Nadia Kailani has been a commissioner of the Superior Court locally since 2019 and as a staff attorney there for a decade. She previously worked at the alternate public defender's office as well as in private practice. She replaces retired Judge Roger W. Crowell. Sherry Thompson Taylor has served as a deputy district attorney in San Diego since 1995, including positions as division chief, assistant chief, and team leader. She fills a vacancy left by the retirement of Judge Margie Woods.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show, which today includes the latest national and statewide headline stories. Plus, we'll have all the top festivals and events coming up on Destination East County, and we'll be re-airing our bookshelf interview with author Diana Lindsay on her book, Coast to Caxias, a guide to hiking and outdoor activities across our region.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Russia has attacked not just us, not just our land, not just our cities. It went on a brutal offensive against our values.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke to Americans Wednesday with a graphic portrait of his country's suffering during the Russian invasion. Zelensky also called for a no-fly zone over Ukraine, more weapons, and tougher economic sanctions. President Joe Biden announced an additional $800 million in military aid to Ukraine for weapons including drones, grenade launchers, and ammunition. He also promised more resources in the coming days.
Make Putin pay the price. Weaken his position.
The White House maintains it will not support a no-fly zone. The Federal Reserve increased the federal funds rate a quarter point Wednesday. The benchmark rate is used by banks to charge on loans and set borrowing costs on credit cards, vehicles, and mortgages. Acting Federal Reserve Board Chair Jerome Powell said he expects the labor market to remain strong, but consumers won't get a breather from inflation anytime soon.
That said, inflation is likely to take longer to return to our price stability goal than previously expected.
Senate Finance Committee members Wednesday held a hearing on prescription drug pricing as inflation drives up prices. Stephanie Stern with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society testified.
It's very common for people with MS, like my mom, to have to rely on some kind of financial assistance to afford their costs. Our studies show around 70% of people rely on financial assistance just so they can pay their out-of-pocket.
According to a new report from the financial resource company Value Penguin, since 2010, consumer spending on prescription and non-prescription drugs has increased every year, and the average household pays around $4,000 for prescription medications. The U.S. Department of Education says historically black colleges and universities that recently received bomb threats are eligible for federal grants to boost campus security. Vice President Kamala Harris said the Biden administration is also releasing a resource guide.
For colleges and universities with detailed information on detecting, preventing, and recovering from threats and acts of violence.
The U.S. Department of Justice has reached a more than $127 million settlement with the families of most of those killed or wounded in a 2018 Florida high school massacre over the FBI's failure to stop the gunman, even though it received information he intended to attack a month before the shooting. The settlement does not amount to an admission of fault by the United States, according to the Justice Department. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
It's Latino Advocacy Week, an initiative designed to empower local groups to go out and effect change in their communities. The Hispanic Access Foundation is holding a series of webinars open to the public on ways to further goals on issues such as conservation and immigration reform. Jessica Godinez with the Hispanic Access Foundation says there is enormous untapped potential and an appetite for change in the Latino community.
Our hope is to really provide our community with the resources and the training to take leadership of their own advocacy.
Godinez notes that every 30 seconds, a Latino American citizen turns 18. As of 2020, 32 million registered voters identified as Hispanic. From 2016 to 2020, Latino voter turnout tripled. And while Latinos comprise 18% of the population, they make up only 1% of elected officials. On Tuesday, as part of Latino Advocacy Week, advocates and policymakers toured the site of the proposed Western Riverside County Wildlife Refuge. Frank Ruiz with Audubon, California, says low-income communities need better access to nature to decompress.
it will improve the quality of life of many of those communities that may not have the opportunity to live in areas where they have better parks. They don't have open green areas. They don't have the infrastructure that many other communities have.
House Resolution 927, the Wildlife Refuge Conservation and Recreation for the Community Act, would establish the urban refuge. The bill has been introduced but has not had a hearing or a vote. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Experts are calling on the FCC to consider recent studies that link fertility problems to radio frequency radiation from cell phones and other wireless devices. The Environmental Health Trust just placed 5 additional studies onto the FCC docket, research that found that wireless radiation can impact the ovaries and reduce testosterone. The Trust's president, Dr. Deborah Davis, says RF radiation can also lead to sperm that are deformed and have trouble swimming.
There is a substantial body of evidence that provides compelling proof that current levels of cell phone radiation can damage the quantity and quality of human sperm.
The cellular industry says its products are safe and meet all government standards. Theodora Scarrato, also with the Trust, notes that last summer a judicial panel ordered the FCC to review its reasons for upholding RF radiation exposure standards developed more than 25 years ago.
We're calling on the government to fully review the science in their upcoming review of the record, because no U.S. federal agency has reviewed all of the science, especially the issues related to reproduction.
Scarrato says there are ways to reduce your exposure to RF radiation.
Keep the phone away from your body. Don't store it in your pocket when the antennas are on. Don't sleep with your cell phone. Don't rest the phone against your abdomen, especially if you're pregnant.
Additional studies have documented a rise in infertility in the U.S., with 19% of women age 18 to 45 unable to conceive after 1 year of trying, and a documented decrease in the percentage of men with normal sperm count. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This week's Destination East County includes a look ahead at some of the most iconic festivals and events coming up soon and throughout the springtime season. The Julian Daffodil Project was started by Sally Snipes in 1990 as a memorial to her father, Jack Snipes, and now there are 4 million bulbs planted in the Julian area. The annual Julian Daffodil Show will be held March 19th and 20th from noon to 5 p.m. at the Julian Hall, where you can see these beautiful blooms. In addition, you can enjoy You Pick Daffodils on Saturdays and Sundays from March 19th all the way through May 1st during Daffodil Days at Julian Farm and Orchard. Daffodils are said to symbolize friendship but also new beginnings. They are one of the first signs of spring and are known in Britain as Lent lilies associated with Easter. Find details at visitjulian.com. Cajon Classic Cruise Car Shows return in the heart of downtown El Cajon, where thousands of people converge to visit displays of classic vehicles each Wednesday night from 5 to 8 p.m. Opening night is April 13th, and the season runs through October 26th. Many attendees enjoy arriving early to dine at local restaurants, including some with outdoor seating. The events customarily also include a DJ with music to liven up the festivities. Find details at downtownelcajon.com. Julian's annual Taste of Julian celebrates the town's diverse culinary delights, proving there's much more here than the community's famed apples. The self-guided tour includes a variety of participating restaurants, bakeries, and tasting rooms for wine, beer, and cider on April 30th from 12:30 to 5 p.m. Early reservations are recommended since this event sells out. Find tickets and details at visitjulian.com. You're invited to experience the history and heritage of San Diego's East County during Campo Day. The event will take place this year on Saturday, April 30th at four separate locations all day long: the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, the Motor Transport Museum, Gaskell Brothers Stone Store Museum, and the Camp Lockett Event and Equestrian Facility. The event will bring life to the community's colorful past, which includes a historic railway, Wild West Shootout, Native Americans, pioneers, cowboy skills, buffalo soldiers, a cavalry camp, and living military history. Plus, there is also an evening dance. For more information, check out visitcampo.com. Vintage Alpine will offer savory tastes from over 40 local wineries, restaurants, and breweries, all in the beautiful gardens of Summers Past Farms in Flynn Springs on May 1st from 1 to 4 p.m. Visitors can also enjoy live music and a silent auction. It's all for a good cause, benefiting the Kiwanis Club of Alpine Foundation, which supports services and programs for children in San Diego County. For tickets and a full list of vendors, visit vintagealpine.com. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Diana Lindsay. My guest is president of Sunbelt Publications and leading editor of the book Coast to Cactus, The Canyoneer Trail Guide to San Diego Outdoors. Coast to Cactus, which was published by Sunbelt in partnership with the San Diego Natural History Museum, contains 245 outings and 73 extension hikes. Welcome, Diana. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the book. I know that it's based on the weekly Romo-Rama column for the San Diego Reader, and it's the field guide to the Natural History Museum's exhibition, Coast to Cactus, Southern California. But summarize, if you will, what readers will find in Coast to Cactus that they may not find elsewhere. How is it unique?
Well, first of all, it's more than a hiking guide. It is also a field guide. So unlike having to take your hiking guide out into an area that you want to explore along with many trail guides for flowers, for birds, for amphibians or reptiles, you can just take this one book, because what it does do is function as a field guide. There's 525 different species that are found in San Diego County that are featured, that have photos in them, that have full descriptions. So this is just the one book that you need to be able to study and learn about the county as you're hiking on a trail.
So that makes it much more practical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's such a wonderfully colorful book.
Yeah, it has 665 color photos in it. It has 258 maps. It also features the habitats that you will find within the county. We're using the system that San Diego State University has on 9 different habitats that are found in San Diego County. And each of the maps has a symbol by it telling you what habitat you will encounter on that hike. So in some hikes, for instance, you may just have a chaparral or a riparian area. So there'll be the symbols for those two habitats next to the map, and you'll know you will encounter that on the hike. But another hike may have 5 or 6 different types of habitats that you will encounter as you are on the trail. So we're trying to teach people to become aware of, when they hike, you know, what types of habitats they actually will encounter on those hikes.
That's wonderful. And can you also explain the map in the beginning of the book with the chapters for depending on which region?
We have a map in the front of the book, and we decided not to use a grid system that many hiking books do use. We wanted to make it easier for the reader, so we have broken up the chapters according to logical areas that are geographical boundaries by freeways. So you can look at an area that's encompassed by, let's say, Interstate 15 or 5 and cross freeways that go, and you can go into that chapter and you will find all the hikes that are within that area. We have the overall breakdown of the book broken into the coastal hikes, the inland hikes, which are the foothills. We have the mountain hikes and the desert hikes. So those are the 4 regions that we cover within the book. And then within each of those regions, we break it down into geographical areas to make it easier for people to find those particular places that they want to explore.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So much to discover.
Yes.
Now, I understand that your company envisioned a hiking guide to the county, but then Jerry Schad's A Foot in a Field was published by Wilderness Press in 1986. How did that desire lead you to the production of Costa Cactus?
Well, my husband and I wrote the guidebook for the Anzabrego Desert region in 1978, and then we had thought beyond that, thinking that what was really needed was a guide to the entire county. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Jerry had been working on the county guide, and he came out with his book. It's a very excellent book. And so that kind of put our desires to do a county book on a shelf, but always we had that in the back of our minds. You know, if we were going to do a book, how could we do it that would be different than what Jerry did that people would be interested in? And at the time, you know, we wanted to learn more about the county and the things that we could see on the trail. And that's when we joined the San Diego Natural History Museum and became canyoneers almost 30 years ago. And to learn about the species and the plants and the habitats that are found on trails. And from that experience, the idea evolved that, well, what if we took this experiences of knowing the species and the habitats and actually integrated it within a guidebook? Would that be something that people would be interested in, and would it actually lead to really learning about the county and helping to understand what is actually found in our county?
How long did it take to put this together? It sounds like an enormous project.
As a canyoneer, I introduced the idea of working on a book such as this about a decade ago, and it seemed like an overwhelming project. So it kind of sat on a back shelf for many, many years, mm-hmm. and actually what happened, Jerry unfortunately had passed away, and I was at his memorial service. And the publisher of the San Diego Reader, Jim Holman, had said that they were looking for somebody to take over the Roma-Rama column, which Jerry had written very wonderful columns throughout the years.
Right.
So I went back to the Canyoneers and I said, you know, we have an opportunity here to actually do this book, and it would be more manageable because all we would have to do is do one article a week until we had enough articles to put it together in a book. And so that's when we made an agreement with my publishing house, the mm-hmm. San Diego Natural History Museum, and the Canyoneers to work on this, and then we began the columns, a weekly column for the San Diego Reader. After several years, we had enough to do a book, and then the real work began. So then
right.
It was about 18 months, 2 years, to then check all the descriptions for the trails to make sure they're accurate, and then to the difficulty here was to make sure that when we did put a species description in, that it was actually found on that trail, and that the description was accurate. So we had to have all the curators with their specialties check everything we wrote. We had to work with all of the agencies where the trails were found and then run the trail descriptions by them to make sure they were accurate. They checked our trails. And so we made sure that not only were the species descriptions correct, that the habitats mm-hmm. that we said were there were correct, but that all of the information regarding those species were correct. And so that was a long project. Yeah, we had two other editors besides myself that worked very closely together. So we made sure that all the descriptions were accurate, and then we went back and forth and double-checked everything.
It really sounds like a labor of love.
Well, actually, it was a labor of love because unlike most books where an author has the royalty and they make money from this book, everybody that worked on this book, all the canyoneers, and there's over 50 people who made contributions to the Roma-Rama articles that we used, and the editors, myself and Paula Noel and Terry Barnell, all of us are volunteers at the San Diego Natural History Museum. So all our work was as a volunteer for the museum, and all the proceeds from the book that a normal author would receive are going to the museum. So when anybody buys
Wonderful.
This book, they're actually supporting the San Diego Natural History Museum.
That's nice to know. Talk a little bit more about the Canyoneers and this exhibit at the museum.
Yes, the Canyoneers are it's a program at the museum that's over 40 years old, and it was started by a botanist, Helen Shamley, at the museum. There was a canyon next to the museum, still there, mm-hmm. a Florida canyon, which was a very lovely canyon. In several years later, after the Canyoneers began, it actually there was a fire there, and that's what resulted in the Canyoneers actually moving out into the county. But the original idea was to have docents that were trained by the museum curators to take the public into the Florida Canyon. They were called the Florida Canyoneers, and to teach people what was in there and the value of that particular habitat. After the fire occurred, the habitat was not as pristine as it once was, so that's when the Canyoneers began to expand to do walks throughout the whole county, which we do now. We do offer free public walks every single weekend, and that is between September and June. You can find the free public walks by going onto the website for the San Diego Natural History Museum or picking up a brochure. No reservations required. Just show up. We break up into small groups, and the whole idea of a canyoneer walk is not to hurry up to get there and hurry up to get back. It's to walk slowly, to look around, to investigate, to smell, to see right. what the interaction is in the habitat with the surrounding plants and species.
So to engage all your senses.
Absolutely. And you asked about the connection to the exhibition, the Costa Cactus Southern California. That exhibition was created to basically get the county and the folks in the county to be aware of the habitats that are found here in the county. But more important than that, to understand that San Diego is a biological hot zone. It's a biodiversity hot zone. There are 32 places in the world that are hotspots, and to be a hotspot means that you have incredible diversity in an area, but you have threatened species or species that have disappeared. And because of that, you want to keep an eye and watch these areas very carefully. And because San Diego is a hotspot, we want people to be aware of what is out here. We want them to become more conscious of conservation for this area. And so that was part of what the exhibit is all about. So you can go to the exhibit, you can learn about the habitats, learn why San Diego is a hotspot, and then you can take the field guide, which is actually a complement to this exhibition, and this is your field guide to get into the field to actually see what's out there. So it complements the exhibition. One mm-hmm. is an actual museum experience, the other one is a field experience.
And do you think this will help conservation efforts?
We certainly hope so. It's, you know, the museum and also my Publication House believe very strongly in what a Senegalese conservationist, Baba Douim, has said. And what he has said is, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We will love only what we understand. And we will understand only what we are taught. And so that's what the exhibition is about. That's what this book is about. It's about teaching folks in San Diego County what is special about this county. And once you learn and get excited about it, you're going to have a personal feeling for it, and you're going mm-hmm. to want to protect it and lead to taking care of these special areas, which as our county grows and more people move into it, we want to make sure these particular areas are protected.
Wonderful. I can't wait to dig into this book. One last question. What is your favorite trail?
Well, I'm known as a desert person, so obviously my favorite trails are all in the Anzabrego Desert State Park area. And those trails kind of vary for me depending on my moods. If I want a kind of a closed-in experience, I like to go into the slot canyons. Those are kind of fun because they're magical, especially with the light changes. If I want to have spectacular views, I might want to go up on Whale Peak and kind of take a look at the views around there. Split Mountain is always great for geology. Coyote Canyon is wonderful because it has the longest running stream in San Diego County. It always has water. Mountain Palm Canyon is wonderful. Mountain Palm Springs, rather. It has just wonderful palm trees that are in there. And then plus, if you go up to Torote Bowl, there's the very rare elephant tree and a spectacular view of the Vallecito Badlands. So there's many special places in the Anzabrego Desert. Fonts Point, a lot of people like to go out there and take a look at that spectacular view, especially at sunset as you look out over the Borrego Badlands. But it's a very special place, so for me, I'm happy almost anywhere in the desert.
And have you always been a desert person?
Well, not really. It's interesting that you should ask that, because this happens to be my 50th anniversary of my introduction to Anzabrego State Park. I had actually met my husband at a mountaineering club at UCLA when we always went backpacking in the Sierras. And when he became a helicopter pilot with the Navy, we were stationed in San Diego. And he would fly over the desert on training missions and said, "Hey, we need to go out and check out that place." And I said, come on, get real. This is a desert. There's nothing there. That's right. Why it's a desert. And so we had a few arguments back and forth because he would say, come on, we really need to check it out. And I finally said, look, if I go one time out there, would you just quit bugging me? So we went. I had a fantastic experience. It was spring. It was Painted Gorge out on Coyote Mountains. The following week, he said, okay, let's go to the Sierras. And I said, can we go back to the desert?
No,
and I've been going ever since. My master's thesis was done on it, and several books have been done on the desert. And I always am anxious to get back to the desert.
Well, thank you for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Our time is up, but it's been wonderful talking to you, Diana.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
For more information on Coast to Cactus, please visit sunbeltpublications.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
How prepared are you for an emergency? For households with children, elderly people, or those with limited mobility, being ready to take action is especially important. Updating your emergency list should start with a checklist. Be sure to have enough supplies for everyone, including people and pets. Check the dates on canned goods and other perishables, and be sure that stored drinking water is still good. Create an emergency plan for your family. Identify two places for the family to meet. One should be somewhere outside your home, but close by, perhaps a neighbor's or a street corner. The other should be a spot away from your neighborhood, just in case the entire area is evacuated and you can't return. Practice an evacuation plan with your family, including children. If they get used to doing something when there is no panic, they will be much less frantic should a real disaster strike. Review emergency plans at your workplace, your child's school or daycare center, friends' homes, and other places where members of your family regularly spend time. Plan safe routes away from your home and business to high, safe ground, and be sure all family members know the routes. Have alternative routes in mind if the first option is blocked. Develop a plan for family pets and livestock, and have a backup plan because some evacuation shelters may not allow animals. Designate a friend or family member outside the area who all family members can call if you become separated, and that way you can know if everyone is safe. Have family members memorize that phone number in case cell phones die and you can't access the phone directory. Keep current important documents in a safe deposit box or send copies outside the area to be kept by a trusted relative or friend. Be sure that you can access your insurance policy and have a copy of your deed, for example. After Hurricane Katrina, when banks were destroyed by flooding and hurricanes, many homeowners had a lot of trouble putting in their insurance claims. Your emergency kit should include, at minimum, a 3-day supply of bottled water, 1 gallon per person per day, plus extra for pets or anyone with special needs, a 3-day supply of packaged, dried, and canned food that can be prepared without cooking, a first aid kit, and essential medicines for all family members, a pet carrier for each pet and pet food, a manual can opener, a portable radio, plenty of batteries, and flashlights kept in waterproof bags, an extra set of car keys, credit cards, and always plenty of cash in case the power is out when ATM machines and credit card machines are not working, special items for infants, elderly, or disabled family members. It's also important to make sure that you always keep plenty of gas in your car. Also be sure you have a car charger for your cell phones. Know how to operate everything if the electricity is off, the keyless entry to your home, and an electric garage door and gates, for instance. If you have a gas main, know how to shut it off in case of a leak or a disaster.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.